rubber star full of all the kids' regrets from this past year. Quinn smiles. When was the last time he smiled so big? He's just so relieved to watch his biggest demon float away into the sky, so relieved to mark this moment as the one in which he can start over. The crowd cheers. Jeff high-fives Quinn. Somebody else hands him a beer. Quinn, thanks. Semi-cute college guy. No problem, man. You're gonna love it. Except no, not so much. Because real life doesn't work like my screenplays. Just ask Marilyn Monroe or James Dean. And so as everyone else around me does watch their balloons turn to Skittles and then into forgotten regrets, I am instead looking 3 feet ahead at the black guardrail, at my balloon flapping frantically, its pink string caught by the wind in the railing. The tipsy masses make their way downstairs in 10 seconds or 10 minutes, I can't tell. I'm just standing here with Jeff next to me, staring at my almost comically stuck balloon. Almost comically. When I finally turn to leave for good and head down to the street, I see something directly across from me on the other side of the roof. Apparently another person's balloon, a green one, became tangled in the railing too. Another guy's, actually. The sun is directly behind his head now, giving this guy the look of both the oldest and youngest person you have ever seen. His features the kind of ageless blur that Jeff's mom paid good money to achieve at the plastic surgeon after his dad cheated on her with both receptionists at the car dealership last October. Long story.
I'll see you downstairs, Quinny, Jeff whispers. Don't, like, read into the balloon thing.
But his voice trails off. He dragged me here tonight. Jeff planned this out with Carly. He believes in signs, and so I have to, too. Best friend law. Okay, I'm coming, I say, but then I don't. I take my house keys out of my pocket, and I step forward, and I pop the pink balloon, bam, and watch it fall to my feet in a pathetic little zigzag. I whip around. The sun is almost set. The other guy is still here, though, and has turned from blurry edges to pencil-sharp lines, drawn to be my exact height and size, but with a confident smirk that says he's never lost anything more than a round of cards. Nice haircut, he goes, grabbing the door and holding it for me before it slams shut. And suddenly, I know exactly what my type is. Chapter 6. You okay in there, Quinny? I have spent so much time swishing with Listerine that when I finally exit Carly's bathroom, my tongue is basically tingling to the point of numbness. In immediate hindsight, not recommended. We should hit the road, Jeff says, crunching a red cup in his hand. I grab it from him and take a swig. Ugh. I say, it's warm. I hate warm Coke. And even worse, he goes, Jesus Christ, it's warm Pepsi. Jeff knows how I feel about non-Coke products. But Carly ran out to get more beer. My eyes must flicker back to the living room because Jeff breaks into his conspiracy grin and goes, I can't believe I'm the one trying to leave and you're the one trying to stay. The king of the loners reinvents himself. No, it's just... Say it, Quinn. Tell him you might have your first genuine crush. I am making up for all categories of lost time tonight. I was the last kid in my class to go through puberty. I want to see the roof guy naked. There, I said it. Like... You haven't been out of the house in 6 months, Jeff says, for me. And so you'll want to go a little bananas tonight. Relief. Close enough. Exactly that. Well then, Jeff says, let's spike your 7-Up with some vodka. I don't even know if 7-Up and vodka go together, but we skip back to the living room like Girl Scouts on an important mission. We're back,
A voice rings out from behind us in the epic front hallway that thinks it's a tunnel. Carly and the rooftop guy reappear together. And the rooftop guy, if anyone missed that. I stand up straight and try to smile in a way that seems casual but approachable. Literally, I am directing myself. But the rooftop guy totally doesn't notice me at all. Maybe he actually hated my haircut. Maybe he's majoring in irony. Worse, maybe he's straight. Okay, so Amir had this idea for a game we can play. Carly goes, stepping past us and setting 2 6-packs of Iron City down on a coffee table that is fashioned, somewhat improbably, out of an old aquarium. But who has time for details? Rooftop guy has a name. Amir. Now that's a hell of a name. Strong, simple, super masculine. The very opposite of Quinn. The partygoers are scattering around me, hunting for scraps of paper. Jeff is waving his hands in my face. They smell like hummus. Earth to Quinn, he goes. Mm-hmm. Have you ever played Celebrity? If I haven't played it with you, no. So, no. It's fun. Okay, Carly says, if you're a native Pittsburgher, you're on my team, and if you're from out of town, you're on Amir's. Shouting an uproar, the hot-as-balls guy from earlier, not my type, not my Amir, announces he is from Wheeling, West Virginia, so the out-of-town team needs to come over here, he goes, because I am not leaving the couch. Instantly, Amir's team crashes onto the sofa in a tight pack. A group of wolves not bred in Pittsburgh. Native Pittsburghers, Carly says, adopting the longest, ugliest version of our local dialect that you can imagine. Let's just sit by the TV. If you don't know anyone from Pittsburgh, look it up on YouTube. You won't believe it. Our accent sounds something like a parrot doing an impression of a fire alarm. Wait, the teams are uneven, says a non-native. You guys have too many. Quinny's not from Pittsburgh, Jeff offers unbelievably. He's from Cleveland. We moved down here when I was like 1, I say. But Carly holds up her hands and does a big rules are rules thing, and I am so frustrated because the last thing I want is to be on a Mirrors team. I'm not ready to join forces. I don't even know how to play this game. Jeff smiles at me like we're in on the same running joke that is my life. We are not. I sit on the floor next to the couch. Somebody hands me 5 torn-up slips of notebook paper, and I go, thanks. And when I'm sitting here long enough without doing anything, this girl literally furrows her brow like Faye Dunaway in Mommy Dearest and goes, can't think of anyone? I clear my throat. Just write down 5 celebrities, she says. You have to see Mommy Dearest, by the way. Oh my God, put it on the list. On the pieces of paper, she continues, 1 celebrity for each paper. She holds out a pen and looks at me like I'm a dangerous alien in neutral clothes, which, let's be honest. Carly's kicking off her sandals. Okay, does everybody have their celebrities? Somebody volunteers his pirate's hat to be used as the bowl for us to put our slips of paper into, and that's when Faye Dunaway says, louder than you'd believe, wait, the cute kid hasn't written down his names yet. I mean, at least she thinks I'm cute. Oh, you can go without me, I say, but a tipsy guy from the Pittsburgh team goes, no way, it has to be even numbers, it has to be. As if party games are known for their fairness, as if that's the chief quality that gets people hooked on the party game circuit. Jeff and I lock eyes, and he breaks into the biggest I'm sorry grin I have seen since the time in elementary school he let it slip to the other boys that I had borrowed 2 of Carly's Barbies after a sleepover. He's clearly remembering only now how completely out of the loop I am about current pop culture. Bro, just think of 5 famous people, a guy from my team says, and so I take the pen from Faye Dunaway, and like a magic wand, it supplies me with insight.
I will use my practically genetic aversion to being ordinary to my advantage. Number 1, Hitchcock. 2, Kubrick. 3, Mankiewicz. 4, Preminger. And for the modern crowd, 5, Tarantino. Yes, yes! Filmmaker celebrities for the ages. I am writing so fast that somebody actually goes, "The kid's on fire!" And I fold my sheets of paper in half and drop them in the pirate's hat. Carly claps her hands together. It's all good. Okay, anyone who hasn't played before, it's like, I don't know, verbal charades, and your team has to guess who you're acting out, and you only get a minute each. No cheating, Jeff goes. He cracks his knuckles and punches his fist into his hand, acting all mock competitive. It makes me laugh. This is going to be fine. First round, Carly goes, grabbing the hat. My house, my rules. Devin, you're up. Somebody offers to time the rounds on their phone, and we're off. Okay, Devin says, looking at her first slip of paper and bouncing up and down a little. Wait, can I, like, pass? 50 seconds left, the timer from the other team says. I dare myself to glance at Amir. He is the only person on our team looking at Devin with a small smile on his face. A face that's distinguished by this jawline you could open a manila envelope with. Anyway, whatever, his little smile, it is the sweetest thing. Everybody else is teasing Devin for being so stuck on the first round. But Amir is smiling, smiling. The kind of smile you have to name twice. Time! The timekeeper calls, and Devin slaps her hands down and goes, I didn't even know who it was. It was like a long Russian name or something. She shows the paper to us, and somebody from the other team kicks her in the butt and says, no cheating. And she falls onto the floor and puts her feet against the aquarium and sighs. Let's go in order of birthdays, someone suggests. Like, whosever birthday is next should just go. A Pittsburgh guy goes, my birthday's on Tuesday. And a bunch of girls go, aw, Josh. Like he just admitted he's not actually a human guy, but in fact 15 puppies in a tank top. Josh gets up and takes the hat, and suddenly the game gets serious, though I'm not really thinking about that. I'm thinking about the fact that my birthday is this coming Sunday. Go. Josh grabs the first celebrity. Okay, he owns like a million buildings and has crazy hair that looks like a frittata. Donald Trump! Josh doesn't even say yes. He just throws the clue down, and we non-natives moan, but also secretly love that now we're all about something together. Life hack, that's all anyone ever wants. Okay, Josh goes. He used to be, like, the biggest movie star ever when our parents were our age, but then he went crazy. Tom Cruise? No. John Travolta? Yes. Ugh, biggest movie star ever? Marlon Brando much? Whatever. Next. Josh twists a piece of hair between his fingers, and he's starting to sweat, and this is the most cardio-intense party game I have ever seen. Okay, Josh goes. You get a car, and you get a car, and you get a car. The Pittsburghers erupt into laughter, and everybody shouts, Oprah! Even my team does. And oh my God, wait till they get to one of my names and are blown away that the cute kid is actually a mature man. Okay, Josh goes, trying not to laugh. I think he was like a famous mime. Time! Carly calls out. She's boogieing around and eating some of the hummus that I brought. Nobody seems to mind the fact that I brought another hummus now. Life can be so weird. Who's up? Who's up? Somebody goes. And since I don't have a phone to pretend I'm getting a text, I fake a big yawn. Quinny, your birthday's on Sunday, right? I am going to kill Jeff. Birthday boy, birthday boy. He attempts to start a chant. Fail. I get up and wonder how sweaty my butt looks in my shorts and if I'll recognize a single celebrity name, and I pray, pray, pray I pick one of my own. I know just how to act out Hitchcock. Please, crouch like birds are attacking, shriek like you're being stabbed in a shower. Easy. Okay, time,
Carly says, for the first time not sounding excited, but rather cautious. Can't blame her there. I literally have no idea who the first celebrity is. Oh, geez. See, this is why I like everything written out beforehand. I am trying to star in my life story, not appear as the unbilled comic sidekick. Say something, a girl from my team says. Say anything. Amir and I catch eyes, and damn it, I look away. Is it a man or a woman? Says Faye Dunaway. I think a man? Oh, Christ. I mean, sorry, definitely a guy. 30 seconds, Carly says. Okay, I say. His last name is, like, French. Gerard Depardieu, a teammate says, and I appreciate, at least, the relatively obscure movie star reference. No, but really good guess. Thanks, I don't need positive reinforcement, I need clues. Yikes. Guys, back off, Carly goes, but oh, God, I don't want to be that kid who everyone has to be nice to because their parents got a handout at the beginning of the year saying their child would be sharing the classroom with someone exceptional. Oh, I say, I swing my arms so wide that it knocks an entire liter of Fanta into a bowl of corn chips. Worth it. His name is like Pepe Le Pew, you know, the, like, possum cartoon thing. He was a skunk, a girl says, wiping Fanta from her leg. You could say it kind of splashed everywhere. And his first name is Italian, I go. Time, Carly hollers. Big hoots from the Pittsburgh team, who are up 3-0. Josh is literally still getting high fives for the John Travolta Oprah sequence. Pepe Le Pew is a skunk, the girl says again, in case I didn't hear her, which I did. Well, who was it? Asks my hot-as-balls teammate, who never even tried to guess during my round, not even once. I thought we weren't showing clues, I say, but now nobody puts up a fight, and so I hold up the celebrity for him to see. Mario Lemieux, he goes. You don't know who Mario Lemieux is. One of the most legendary penguins of all time, somebody else adds. Ugh, a hockey reference. The clue might as well have been written upside down, in Arabic. Jesus, you call yourself a Pittsburgher? No, I sit down. I'm from Cleveland. The hot-as-balls guy leans forward. Now I see what he's doing. He is impressing the girl next to him. You could have literally just said this guy's first name was one of the most iconic Nintendo characters of all time. I try not to scrunch my eyebrows at him, but whoops. Super Mario Brothers, he goes. Hello, are you secretly 90? The girl next to him giggles and whaps his shoulder in a you big lug kind of way. They are definitely doing it later tonight. I hug my knees. I am the last American virgin. So whose birthday is next? Carly tries to say, but it's as if the sound man forgot to turn on her microphone. That's the effect her prompt has. Nothing. I get up to take the ruined corn chips to the kitchen, also to launch an investigation into whether my face is incredibly hot or incredibly cold. It's one or the other. And as I set the bowl in the sink, a spider crawls out from beneath the windowsill and startles me enough that I back up hard into somebody. Sorry, I say. With my luck, it's probably the girl whose bright white jeans were splashed with Fanta. Nope, it's worse. No problem. It's Amir. We made actual physical contact, and I didn't even have the benefit of experiencing it face to face. I mumble something and duck my head down, sidestepping out of the kitchen, taking great notice of the floor, of exquisite dust bunnies and a fascinating paperclip, of anything but up. We should go, Jeff says, when I nearly crash into him, too. First shift at Loco Moca. But that's not what he's saying, or what he's meaning, anyway. The minute we got your air conditioner today is what he's really saying. We should have just gone back to install it and never let you leave home again. That's the one dangerous thing about having a best friend. You can always tell when they're glad not to be you. Chapter 7. We have to pull off of I-79 because Jeff's Corolla is running super low on gas. Usually, he just fills it up for free at his dad's dealership. Did you know car dealerships have their own on-site gas stations? I didn't. So tonight, Jeff is in his version of a pissy mood because he actually has to pay to refill his tank. Jeff's version of pissy is still pretty optimistic. "Hey, Quinny," he says, sticking his head through the driver's window from outside. "Can you pump for a second? I actually really have to take a leak." "Sure." I unbuckle and walk around and take the nozzle from him, and when he stumbles away a little bit, I go, "Are you, like, sober enough to drive?" And he goes, "Now you ask me," which isn't exactly an answer. It's been a while since I've pumped gas. Annabeth drove our only car that day. We haven't gotten it replaced. "Holy shit, Quinn Roberts," I hear. Even though the pump clicks off at that very moment, my hand reflexively turns back into a fist, clamping it back on. Auto fists are what auto happen whenever I hear Blake Thompson's voice. "Hey, Blake," I go, unclenching my hand. "Hey," he goes. I turn to see which kind of face he's making at me. It's always a face with Blake Thompson, but it's his arms that I zero in on. They're overflowing with snack foods. Utz chips and Mountain Dews, you get the idea. "You want one of these?" he goes. Apparently, I am staring at a Clark bar. "No, it's cool," I go. And then Jeff's flip-flops are slapping back across the parking lot. He gets in front of me like he's a mother lioness. "You need something, Thompson?" Jeff goes. I slink away and open the passenger side door and just stand behind it as if it's a shield. "No, we're good," Blake says. He turns abruptly toward his truck, and as he does, a Sierra Mist falls out of his arms. It rolls onto Jeff's foot. Jeff tosses it into Blake's pickup truck window for him, and Blake takes off without saying anything else, his truck belching smoke, one of his rear taillights blinking like a carnival. We're pulling out of the gas station and are a full 1 minute back into the trip before Jeff goes, "Buckle up." My mom was always strangely lax about making us buckle up. And then, "That was weird back there." I know what he means, but I don't, either. "Yeah," I say. "Did Blake give you shit when I was inside?" "No," I say, opening Jeff's glove compartment for a Jolly Rancher. He's out of my favorite flavor, but I'll persevere. "No, he didn't give me shit at all. He was oddly nice." "Well, that's cool," Jeff goes, turning onto my driveway without using the turn signal. Thank God. It was beginning to bother me how conscientious Jeff has been seeming. "Yeah," I say, "but I'm not thinking it was cool. I'm thinking I wish Blake had been a total jagoff to me back in the Marathon gas parking lot off I-79, because then we'd be back to how life was before December 20th. Blake Thompson being nice to anybody means they are permanently in the leper category, officially not worth picking on. I am now the guy people pity. Don't pity me, people. Make fun of my haircut, my dad's cologne, even. Treat me like you treat everybody." "You want to get out?" Jeff says, because I guess I'm just sitting here in the driveway, buckled up, looking at the birch tree where Annabeth and I tied the strayed dog we were so excited to find, which Dad didn't let us keep. I've got a hefty bag out, and I'm filling it with 3 expired healthy choices at a time. Then I'm on my knees, twisting open jars of cinnamon applesauce and trying to figure out if anything in the fridge is still edible. Question: can jelly grow mold? Answer: it can. I'm not being that quiet about any of this either. Mom's upstairs in her room watching her stories on full blast, so I should be good. 10 minutes and 2 full hefty bags later, I have moved on to confronting our pantry, which is also where Dad kept this big animal cracker barrel for loose coins. It's the most unlikely thing ever, sitting there on the top shelf. In order to put your spare change into it, you have to get out the step stool, which is missing its top ladder rung, and balance on the top without falling and dying. And so we never do. If this isn't a metaphor for the Roberts family's approach to savings, I don't know what is. Oops, never mind about me not disturbing Mom. I hear her door swing open upstairs and these gravelly voices from her police procedurals filling the stairwell. It's actually nice to have a man's voice in the house again. Surprise, here she comes. Hi, Mama, I say when she steps off the stairwell, the bun in her hair blocking the fake stained glass moon in the window above our front door. Babe, what are you up to in here? Just clearing stuff out, Ma. I've decided we have to start eating better. She negotiates, walking quickly into the kitchen, which you'd think would sound like a thunderstorm, but is instead something even more ominous. The low groan of a boiler about to explode. That was the original ending of The Shining, by the way. In the novel, the boiler explodes and kills them all. Obviously vastly different from the movie. Spoiler alert. Quinny, Mom says, her forehead in a twist, why would you throw away all this good food? I pull a Cocoa Krispies box out of the hefty bag and shake it. There is a delayed response from inside, the cereal ka-chunking against the box like it's been awakened from the terrible reality of being, well, Cocoa Krispies. I don't know if we can call this food good, Mama. But that was her favorite. I lower the box. I stick my head into the hefty. She's right. I have just completely disrupted the museum that was Annabeth's life. Shit. Well, maybe I could toss out some of the stuff she never touched? I pick out a string cheese from the hefty bag. Annabeth hated string cheese, even before it was flecked with green like this one is now. Like this? It starts with a quiver. Mom's breakdowns always start with a little quiver, either chin or eyelid, and you really have to be artful about spotting it. She is a beautiful woman, but also a large woman. I suppose, she says, but it's her chin this time. It's quivering. I touch her on the shoulder. It's not okay. She's not ready for this. Go watch your stories, I say, and I'll put everything back. She looks away. She's embarrassed. She is grieving. Damn it, Quinn, don't embarrass your mom. You are smarter than this. Just for now, she says. For now, I want everything back the way it was. I'm just not ready. She places her hand on the counter, right on top of that postcard advertising bold summer haircuts. I've got to pee, I say, and I dash up the stairs. I'll put all the food back in a sec. I took the liberty of doing your whites while you were out, Mom calls out, just as I'm discovering a stack of underwear outside my bedroom in the most perfect pile you have ever seen. I stare at it as if a baby has been delivered to my door. You went in my room? I say. I didn't have to pee. I just had to get away. I'm tired of seeing you in that t-shirt, she says, and I cleaned out some of the clutter, too. I stomp my foot down once, hard. I am mad, and I don't know why. Why am I mad to see clean laundry? And then it hits me. I throw my door open and skid across my floor, rug burning my knee with something even worse because I don't have a rug. Ignore. My lamp topples over, but I ignore that too, frantic as I pull my desk away from the wall to search beneath it. It's there, streaked with sweat. The form for that student filmmakers competition, which Mom never even knew we were thinking of applying to. The application feels like a bomb in my hand, ticking off all the things I was going to do but didn't until, boom. See, in order for us to even apply to the competition, I would have had to first finish a full-length screenplay. That was the plan. I'd finish my screenplay, Annabeth would shoot a few scenes, and what the hell, we'd apply to this competition thing. If we had gotten in, it would have meant a real mentor and, better yet, a couple of weeks away in L.A. this summer. Nothing sounds better than away right now. Tick, 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 boom. I take the application across the room. I open my closet. I jump up and slide it on top of the teetering stack of textbooks I haven't touched since December 20th. I'm happy to do your colors, too, Mom calls from downstairs. My lips taste like contact lens solution, like salt and saline and oyster brine. I'm still mad, but I'm also not. Okay. I don't understand how somebody as skinny as me is supposed to keep all of these conflicting emotions inside without bursting a few seams. Entire seasons have shifted since the last time I did a proper load of laundry. I gather every last black sock and blue sweatshirt into my broken hamper, and I walk them all down to the basement, where Mom is now leaning into the washing machine. Thanks, I say. I kiss her on the cheek. My mouth descends a full inch into her face, like when you haven't ridden your bike all year and the first time on, you're like, damn it, Dad needs to fill up these tires. Mom's cheeks have that kind of give to them. It's adorable. I go upstairs. I find my earplugs. And now I'm lying on my bed, wondering how Jeff and I could have been so incredibly intent on getting me a new AC today and then have completely forgotten to install it after the party tonight. How it's just sitting in the trunk of his brand new Corolla while I broil. The house shifts. Left to right, left to right. Here she comes. Knock, knock, Mom says, standing outside the threshold of my room. I love how she's suddenly pretending to respect my privacy, even though she barged in here earlier and straightened my desk and did my whites and threw away my towering pizza box art. I found something in the back pocket of your shorts. Oh, earplugs out. You did? I am the least scandalous teen on earth, so I'm not sure why I'm instantly nervous. What do I think Mom might have found? Not a condom, not a cigarette, a nothing. I have the secret life of a retired librarian. All I do is read screenplays and watch movies. I don't even know if 7-Up mixes with vodka because I forgot to take a sip almost the moment I was handed the red cup tonight. Mom makes her way across my room and hands me a tiny slip of paper. I lied earlier, Mom says. Red flag, Mom never lies. I said I did your laundry because I'm tired of seeing you in that t-shirt. I cover myself. I'm in my old robe, but it feels weird for Mom to see my bare legs on my bed or something. Okay, I go. My feelings weren't hurt. Don't worry, I'm tired of that shirt too. She waves away my words. No, I mean, I saw that you went into Daddy's closet. You left it open after. Oh. And I won't have you wearing that man's clothes. Just in case he comes back, by the way. She hates him, but mostly she hates him for leaving, and so we'd better not disturb his stuff. She hates him, and she wants him back, and her daughter too, while you're at it, God. Oh, yeah, of course, Mom. Yeah, I hate his clothes too. She attempts a smile, false start. Maybe when we get the next grocery delivery, we can add some new cologne to the order, too, because I won't have you smelling like him either. And she flips around and attempts to make a quick, witty exit. When the last stairway step has stopped squeaking, I unfold the slip of paper Mom gave me, and I hear a gasp. And it's me who's gasping, and I taste humidity in the intake, and I gasp again. It's just I am so shocked by what I see that my writer mind takes over, as if I am watching the movie of my life from overhead. a removed witness who still believes this screenplay has a chance of ending happily. Interior, Quinn's bedroom, night. Quinn sits up straight on his twin bed. His maroon robe falls open, but he doesn't adjust it. He is too distracted. We see his eyes widen as he stares at a slip of paper in his hand. Over his shoulder, we see it's the exact same slip of paper on which the celebrity name Mario Lemieux had been written earlier tonight. Only now, written above Mario Lemieux, in different handwriting, are the words, "I had no idea who," and underneath Mario Lemieux is written, "was either." Quinn. Oh my freaking God. We tilt down to see what Quinn sees. That underneath, "I had no idea who Mario Lemieux was either," is a name and a phone number. The name is Amir. Cut to exterior, Quinn's roof, night. Quinn dances around in the rain, his robe fully open, his mouth filling with the holy water of redemption. Except, hello, no, because you can't stand on our roof without falling off, and it's not raining out. Who cares, though? The first part of the scene is really happening. I couldn't have written it better. Amir doesn't know who a legendary hockey player is either. Amir is not majoring in irony. Amir is not straight. People, this is what we know so far. Interior, Quinn's bedroom, night. Quinn paces, staring at the slip of paper and giggling. But there's fear on his face, too. Or maybe just annoyance. Ugh. When Rory C. Lewis came out at school last year, the principal called a diversity assembly to honor him, which was the 40 longest minutes of my life, and I am including gym class in that tally. Rory gave a speech on the beauty and drama of being different and got kind of an obligatory standing ovation. But the truth is, nobody ever made fun of Rory because he was gay, even before he was out, even though we could all tell he was gay. We didn't care that he was gay. We made fun of Rory because he's annoying. I'm still not out. It just seems like such a hassle to come out. I want to just be out. I look at the sheet of paper. My hands are making it flutter. I wonder how Amir got this into my back pocket. Maybe when I backed up into him at the sink. I wonder if Mom knows what this piece of paper means. Maybe not, actually. You know how older gay guys always say their moms knew when they finally came out to them? I knew from the beginning, these Hollywood-sensitive moms always seem to be saying. That's not how it'll go with my mom. Sorry, she is as old-fashioned as you can get. She was shocked when she found out I was a friggin' vegetarian. She's been dropping hints about me marrying Tiffany Devlin, the six-toed girl across the street, since the day they moved in. I was 10. I get off my bed. I am suddenly hungry for lunch meat. I'm not a vegetarian anymore. But there's no lunch meat in my mini fridge. Of course there isn't. All I've got is a six-pack of Sprite, saved for special occasions. I look at Amir's handwriting again. It is so boyish and messy that I want to eat it. In 10 seconds, I have torn everything off the corkboard above my desk. And when every last elementary school ribbon is fully cleared, I tack a pushpin through the O of Mario Lemieux. But all I'm really looking at is Amir's phone number. And then I celebrate. For once, I celebrate. I drink 2 Sprites back to back until I get the biggest and greatest stomach ache ever and forever, amen, and I don't even burp. I just hold it all in, and somehow my seams don't burst. Chapter 8. See, this is what I mean. Where is your dad when you need him to fill your bike's tires? I am in the garage after the most sleepless night in forever, starring sweat and boners. My old bike, covered in a veritable carpet of cobwebs, is straight out of an early career Tim Burton movie. I hose it off and find our air pump and after taking 6 minutes to figure out even how to fill up the tires, I mount the seat and bust out laughing. Man, this thing is set for a different Quinn. A younger one. A shorter one. The one who is a brother. I adjust the seat, and then I duck my head inside the house and go, "I'll see you later, Mom. I'm off to solve the case of who broke into my room last night and made my clothes clean." And I'm saying it in my uptight detective voice that always makes her giggle. And so when the door shuts behind me and I hear Mom's laughter fill the sunroom, that feels really great. 5 minutes down Morrow Road, a car from behind gives me this quick honk honk, and I'm not sure if it's a "sorry about your sister" honk, or a "nice haircut, homo" honk, or a "hey, you're riding in the middle of the road and you're going really slow" honk. But all three of those things are entirely possible, and so I pull over where the road forks and take a breath. Is today the day to make a right and coast by the school and see the mural of my big sister looking like a big pug? I lift my tires from the grass and face them left. Another day. And just before I take off again to find Jeff at Loco Mocha and get an iced something, because, oh my god, an iced anything will be delicious today, the first nutrition I've actually earned in, half a year, I spot a firefly on a daisy. "Hello, little firefly," I say. "You're not supposed to be outside in the daytime." Basically, it is unbelievable how sweet I can be when nobody is watching. Exterior, hill outside Quinn's neighborhood, day. Quinn wipes the sweat from his neck and kneels down to press his finger to a daisy. The firefly looks at him and smiles. Firefly: "Are you my friend?" Quinn is startled to hear the firefly speak, especially since he generally hates animated films. Quinn: "Sure, if you're willing to have a male friend named Quinn." The firefly laughs, her butt lights up. Firefly: "You're funny." Quinn: "I am." Firefly: "You are." Quinn: "That's nice. It's been a while since anyone said that." The firefly steps onto Quinn's finger. It's been a long time since anything has trusted him like this. I wipe the sweat from my neck and kneel over. For 2 seconds, I actually allow the possibility that the firefly might actually speak to me. But when I press my finger to the flower, she just flies away. "Hey, do you carry helmets?"
"Aisle 6.
I'm working on a new theory. The new theory is that every person gets corrupted at some point. That there is a moment that changes you forever, from this to that, innocent to wary. Example: Tiffany Devlin, across the street, was born with 6 toes on her left foot. And one day in the 4th grade, she arrived as the new girl in school, and we all just instantly nicknamed her Toe-phany, like it was Lord of the Flies. Now, it was not particularly original as slurs go. This is coming from Queen Roberts. But you get the drift. You don't want to be called Toe-phany if you're a kid with 6 toes. That day was Tiffany's corruption. Welcome to the neighborhood. I bend over in this sports equipment place and hunt for the cheapest helmet. There are so many options here that I feel like I'm shopping for air conditioners again. Anyway, the minute you get corrupted is the moment you understand what it feels like to lose something. Not when you lose a Little League game. Not when you lose a grandparent, even. That's not a scandal. That's nature. What's everybody doing, crying over their 85-year-old Nana dropping dead in her nursing home in the middle of Crafts Day? What did you think was going to happen? That Nana was going to be the first person, literally ever, who bucked the trend known as the life cycle? Not a scandal. Roll the credits. I walk this $17 jet black helmet to the cash register up front. See, I'm buying it because after the firefly flew away, I got back on my bike and this car whipped around the fork blasting country music, always trouble, and it nearly killed me flat. Like, I felt the hair on my face, I don't really have to shave yet, it's like a step up from peach fuzz, get literally grazed. Now that I know what it's like to lose something real, December 20th was my corruption, Everything is different. You start doing stuff like buying yourself helmets, even if you're only 16. You start thinking, maybe I ought to remember to buckle up right away from now on. It's not that I particularly know what I'm living for anymore. I'm an extremely limited filmmaker without the vision and silent encouragement of my sister, the only person I ever read my first drafts out loud to. I just can't stand the thought of Mom losing both her kids in a single year. I mean, really, I love a good terms of endearment as much as the next guy, but not as my fucking life. Jeff is working the coffee counter. I get in line and start to get really giggly that he hasn't noticed me yet. He's gonna flip. He's got the branded Loco Mocha hat on and everything. He looks cute for Jeff. Something's off, though. Quinn! He spots me, finally, and flashes the Goonie grin. How did you get here? Your dad gave me a free Corolla. Wait, what? I'm kidding. Jeff comes out from behind the counter and gives me one of those straight boy half hugs. I realize what's off now. His mustache, literally, thank God. Jesus, you could have warned me, he says, pulling away. Sorry. My body is now where sweat goes to party. Can I get your order started? He asks. He is so psyched and runs back around behind the glass case. Yes, which size iced coffee is big enough for me to bathe in? This girl behind the counter kind of glares at Jeff. He nervous laughs. Do you want a caffeine level 4? He says. There are 4 sizes at Loco Mocha. Even the level 1 has enough jolt to fuel an overnight study binge. Make it a 2. Will the following guest please step down, the girl says, and she scoots Jeff out of her way with her hip. He gives me the sorry grin. When's your next break? I ask him. The girl rolls her eyes and doesn't even look at Jeff. You can take a 5 now, but you have to come back early from lunch. Cool. He whips off his hat like it's a costume, and we walk to 2 large leather chairs across the store and plop down. The chair cushions hiss and wheeze and kind of burp, which makes us laugh because we're secretly still 13 years old. You still have my AC, I go. Yes, he says, I know. I literally got to the end of your street last night and pulled over and texted you 100 times, but, you know, if you never turn your phone on, you can't receive messages. I'm not turning the phone on again. I'm anti-cell these days. Nobody but the police and my therapist know why. Thank God it didn't get out to the local press. I can barely live with myself as it is without people knowing the full story. You are literally worse with technology than my nana. My nana sends me GIFs, Quinn. My nana. I thought his nana dropped dead during Crafts Day last year. I've got to stop rewriting other people's lives. You should stick around for my lunch break, he says. We'll pop over to the Verizon store. It is time to get a new phone. I wave him away. You could have just walked right back through our front door last night. That never stopped you before. I needed that air conditioner. Jeff is using his finger to doodle something invisible into the arm of his chair. His autograph, I think. He wants to be famous. He just doesn't know what for yet. I love him for this. I didn't want to freak out your mom, Jeff says. The porch light was off. Boring scene. Change the stakes. So, something happened last night, I say to him. My heart plays hopscotch, and it isn't just the caffeine. This moment is the reason for the entire bike excursion, but here's another theory. When you've got big news, don't even think about how you'll write it or you'll choke. Same goes for standardized tests, by the way. Jeff, the girl calls over, cocking an eyebrow from behind the counter. A line is forming. Okay, what? He says to me. Be quick. Perfect, that's all I want this to be. But I feel my face close in on itself, like Mom's does when she doesn't get my humor. I'm not confused, though, just unsure about how to deliver this. Is this a comic scene? Where does this occur in the screenplay of my life? And is Jeff's character going to be weirded out? I'm in my head. Damn it, don't write, Quinn, just talk. Dude, he says, but in a sweet way. I look around to make sure we're not being overheard. Some terrible jazz music plays overhead, and when the horns get loud, I get quiet. "You know when we were little," I say, "and I used to put your sister's ballet tutus on my head before we knew it was kind of strange for boys to do that?" Jeff puts his palm up to my face and stands. "Quinn, is this about you being gay? I literally don't care at all." What? He knows? Wait, Jeff knows. Wait, did somebody tell him? Wait, I've never told anyone. "I have to get back to work," he says. "Can we not make a big deal out of this? Unless, I mean, you want to." "Jeff, for real," the girl goes, but I realize she's not a girl. She's a manager. She's still training Jeff. "One sec, Vanessa, this is important." I go, hoping the song will get even louder. "Bring on the cymbals." I'm not sure if I'm gay or what. I might be bi. Jeff snort laughs and punches my shoulder. "Yeah," he says, "and I might be European." I don't know what this means other than Jeff is not European. He puts his hat back on. "Quinn, I've known for, like, ever. Unless you're confessing that you're in love with me." He stops. His face goes a little white. "Oh, God. I mean, if you are, I'd be flattered, but... Ew, Jeff, please, you name your farts, seriously." We laugh. We laugh hard. He heads back to the counter just as his manager gets a call on her cell. When she crouches behind the seasonal drink display in order to take it, she thinks that nobody's watching her, but I am. I see everything. It's haunting. It is not a gift to see everything, believe me. "Okay, I guess I'm heading home then," I say. Turns out this is a very minor scene. Might even end up on the cutting room floor. I like that. "No," Jeff goes after he rings up another customer. "You are getting a phone at the Verizon store, and then you're texting me which foreign film we're seeing tonight." I hate foreign films. Who said I want to see a foreign film tonight? I don't want to have to read at a movie. "My bad," Jeff says, resting his elbows on the counter. "I thought all gay dudes were, like, obsessed with foreign films." He is teasing. "Jeff, keep your voice down." I look around again. "Relax." "You relax, you big queen," he says. I gasp again. He is totally poking fun at me. He is totally the best. I turn to the parking lot, shaky, but then, "Hey," I say back to Jeff, "what happened to your mustache?" Okay, imagine the theme music to Jaws, because his manager is back. She takes a rag and wipes down the counter, and when she sees that Jeff isn't busy, she literally puts his hand on the rag to take over. And then she looks at me like I'm in her living room ruining Christmas morning. "The mustache," the manager says, "to me, wasn't professional looking." Jeff gently puts his head against the refrigerated food case and closes his eyes like he's really embarrassed. I take a step toward him. He looks up. The manager turns to the next customer. Jeff winks at me. "See you later, girlfriend," he says. "Jeff, I will kill you." But there we go again, laughing. I pivot away and hold the icy cup up to my neck in preparation for the smack of heat outside. But just before I'm out the door, Jeff goes, "Psst," like we're 7 years old, making a couch cushion fort in his basement. Back when our parents were friends and our big sisters took ballet together, and we weren't gay or straight, we were just Quinny and Jeffy. "Yeah?" I say. "Amir Turani?" Jeff says, louder than Annabeth would have directed him to speak. "Thinks you have a cute butt." Chapter 9. I am late for staring practice. "Like I said," my therapist goes, adjusting her laptop screen and giving me a nostril view that one could describe as vivid. "We can use your remaining time however you'd like, Quinn. We're 30 minutes into our regular 45-minute Skype session, but we're really just 3 minutes into it. See, It wasn't till Jeff and I had taken seats in the almost sadistically powerful air conditioning of his Corolla and each had a foot-long hoagie, I waited for his lunch break, that I even realized I was missing the only Thursday therapy session I've ever actually wanted to have. You have never seen a guy pedal home so fast. Sparks flew from my wheels, at least in my mind. I've just got a ton to figure out today, I say, still willing my heart to slow down. Start from the beginning, then. Well, I can barely concentrate, though, because hovering just above my laptop screen is Amir's handwriting on the slip of celebrity paper. Incoming boner. I met a guy, I say in a quiet way, at this party. My therapist barely conceals a smile. I see. She stares and stares. Damn it, she has picked up on my techniques and mastered them. Am I allowed to, like, talk about sex stuff with you? Gah, I want to slam my computer screen shut. My therapist is the stepmom of this second-tier boy at school. She sees me for a deeply discounted rate because her son was friends with Annabeth and they feel bad for us. Well, of course you can talk about sex stuff, she says. For many people, that's all they talk about. Wow. Okay.